Lecture 22, Cities of the Indus.
This lecture also focuses on the discovery of civilization in Asia. But this time we travel to the south, to India and Pakistan. This is the realm of some of the great civilizations of the pre-industrial world, the Harappan civilization of the Indus, the Mauryan civilization of the Ganges, and other great societies. And the story of their discovery involves some colorful characters. The first part of this lecture describes John Marshall's pioneer discoveries of Buddhist civilization on the Ganges. In the second section, we'll recall how during the 19th century, British railroad engineers working in what is now Pakistan used hundreds of fired mud bricks from ancient city mounds by the Indus River as rail ballast. And from there, we'll describe the discovery of the Harappan civilization in the 1920s, with its far-flung trading connections with ancient Mesopotamia and Bahrain. This discovery can be attributed in large part to John Marshall, who gave, unfortunately, but a crude portrait of the Harappans. But this was filled out by the excavations of one of the most remarkable archaeologists of the 20th century, the Englishman Mortimer Wheeler, in 1945-46. Wheeler excavated the ancient Harappan cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, which is now only being modified, his work, by new research described in the final part of this lecture. In 1902, a man called John Marshall was appointed the Director General of the Archaeological Survey of India, an institution founded by the British Raj. John Marshall was born in 1876 and died in 1958. His life straddled a very important period in the discovery of civilization, when amateur digging and spectacular finds were replaced by much more rigorous archaeological science. But, like Leonard Woolley and others of his day, Marshall was trained in the classics and was an experienced excavator, having learnt his craft by simply doing the job alongside more experienced archaeologists and then going off on his own. He had, for the time, a very broad experience. At the time he came to India, he'd worked in Greece, Crete, and Turkey. He remained the Director General of Antiquities for India for 26 years and was the first archaeologist to unearth early South Indian civilization. Now, this was a much harder job than you might imagine. It was a job subject to political pressure. It was a job where constantly you were dealing with the forces of Indian nationalism, which was becoming increasingly powerful in the early 20th century, and with the forces of the British Raj, which, after all, was a form of colonial government. So Marshall had to tread a very fine line in his research and his administration of his job. So it's hardly surprising that one way of coping with this was to deal with relatively uncontroversial subjects. So at first, he worked in northern India, where he studied the strong connections between that region and the classical world to the west. He began by digging early Buddhist sites, by working from there, in the relatively recent period, back further into time. Now, one thing did separate Marshall from many of his contemporaries. In this way, he was somewhat like Leonard Woolley. He was interested not just in spectacular monuments, not just in the lives of rulers and lords, but in the lives of ordinary people. So he spent a great deal of his time investigating cities and villages. He looked for evidence of life in the past, for the dynamics of societies. This is one reason why his excavations are not as well known as they should be. They were an important contribution to the study of early civilization, even if his methods were somewhat crude. Probably his most important discovery was not on the Indus at all. It was the first excavations of a much later civilization, that of the Mauryans, based on the Ganges Valley. This was a Buddhist state, which flourished from about 269 to 232 BC and expanded as far north as Nepal. Interestingly, too, the Mauryans and their successors were the first people to encourage trade between India and Southeast Asia, where civilizations were to arise in the hands of the Khmer and others during the late first and early second millennium AD in relatively recent times. But, as I said, this was relatively uncontroversial work. Buddhism was recognized by the British Raj as a great religion. Its connections, the Mauryan connections, with the classical world were considered an important part of the study of Western civilization. Marshall also excavated far in the north. He excavated the great frontier city of Taxila, now in northwestern Pakistan, which was a vital trading center between the east and the west, between the 5th century BC and the 5th century AD. In other words, they were almost looking at India as a sort of expansion or province of the Roman Empire, which it never was, but a sort of the connection with the west was far more important than early civilizations in India. Anything that really smacked of indigenous origin was something which was kept quiet or had nationalist overtones. It was very tricky. During the early 1920s, Marshall's interests changed somewhat. He heard stories about the mud bricks which had been used by the thousand to build the railroad beds in modern-day Pakistan. His interests became diverted from the north to the much hotter, more inhospitable environment of the Indus Valley, to the ancient cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, which were long known as important archaeological sites and indeed as the source of bricks, right since the mid-19th century. At Harappa in the Punjab, civil engineer William Brunton had ransacked the city of 200 acres for fired bricks. He used them by the thousand as railroad ballast while building the Lahore-Karachi Railroad. His workmen recovered carved steatite seals, but he thought they were relatively modern. It was, he thought, a city of relative unimportance, so he just robbed it for brick. The brick was ideal for railroad bed. He was wrong. In fact, these were the earliest cities in India. Early in 1920, two locally trained archaeologists, and this is very interesting, Indians were involved here from a very, very early stage, Dayaram Shani and R.D. Banerjee, the latter becoming a well-known archaeologist, excavated Harappa and Mohenjo-daro. Harappa in 1920 and Mohenjo-daro in 1922. They quickly discovered evidence of an ancient and hitherto unknown civilization. Marshall, who was a generous man, arranged for the publication of the finds by these two Indian archaeologists in a famous, popular, and very influential journal, the Illustrated London News, which at the time was the place where new archaeological discoveries were published for a wider audience. What was remarkable about the Illustrated London News was that their coverage was not purely Western, it was international. And the Harappa materials were truly a remarkable opportunity for exposure of Indian civilization to a much wider audience. I myself can testify to the influence of the Illustrated London News, because many years ago in my early career I had a discovery which I wrote up for Illustrated London News at their request, and it was amazing the number of inquiries I got from it. And this one really put the Harappans on the map. But the most interesting thing about it was there's some archaeologists working in southern Iraq on the Sumerians identified finds in Iraqi cities which were identical to those from Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. These suggested that these cities, because these were well dated in Iraq, dated to the 3rd or 4th millennium BC. So these cities were clearly part of a much larger international world. They were very much relevant to the study of the origins of civilization. So it was small wonder that Marshall himself and another excavator named Ernest Mackay now dug extensively at both cities. These excavations were awarded with spectacular discoveries. Entire buildings, streets, citadels, figurines, and again, artifacts which connected the Indus civilization or the Harappan civilization to Mesopotamia and the Persian Gulf. Mackay, who had worked in Bahrain in the Persian Gulf, realized immediately that what he called the Indus civilization, not the Harappan civilization, which is a later term, had maintained trading connections with areas where he had worked before, with the Persian Gulf and Mesopotamia. Unfortunately, the excavation methods used by Marshall and Mackay were rough and ready, and a great deal was missing, and there were large gaps in the account of the Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro excavations, which required further excavation. This early phase in the discovery of the Harappans ended before World War II. And the Antiquities Service in India fell into considerable disarray with the retirement of Marshall. After an inquiry and an investigation by none other than Leonard Woolley of Ur fame, it was decided to invite a well-known archaeologist to India to overhaul the Antiquities Department and to train a new generation of archaeologists. And the person whom Woolley recommended and others was one of the most colourful and flamboyant archaeologists of the 20th century, and a brilliant excavator, Mortimer Wheeler, or, as he later became, Sir Mortimer Wheeler. In 1944, he was appointed Director General of the Archaeological Survey of India, charged with reviving what had become a moribund institution. Mortimer Wheeler, and I was lucky enough to know him personally, was a compelling character. He trained at London University, served with distinction in World War I as an artillery officer, which gave him a background in military organization and discipline that was to affect the rest of his career. In the 1920s, he served as director of the National Museum of Wales, where he conducted a series of excavations on Roman sites. Now you'll recall that much earlier in this course, I mentioned a remarkable Victorian general, General Lane Fox Pitt Rivers, who was a pioneer in scientific excavation. He unexpectedly, as I told you, inherited a great deal of money and land, and devoted his later years to excavating archaeological sites on his estates at Cranbourne Chase in southern England. and he developed some very important principles of detailed recording, precise excavation, methods that were ignored by most of his contemporaries. And in the 1920s, a great deal of archaeological excavation was still like digging a plantation of potatoes, rough in the extreme. But Wheeler, who had read his Pitt Rivers, adopted and refined Pitt Rivers' methods and excavated not only in Wales, but later in Britain, with a standard and a meticulousness which staggered his contemporaries. And one of the greatest developments in archaeology in the 1920s and 30s in Europe was the great refinement of excavation methods at the hands of people like Wheeler and others, who realized that excavation with destruction, and that excavation done precisely and recorded precisely, preserved finite archives of the past. His methods were military, they were colorful, they were tyrannical, his standards were very high, but he trained generations of students in excavating. It is safe to say that excavation methods in Britain are almost entirely today the result of his pioneer work. When World War II came along, Wheeler once again joined the army, rose to the rank of brigadier, and served with distinction as an artillery officer in North Africa. And then suddenly, in 1944, he was asked to become Director General of the Archaeological Survey of India, and accepted the position. Now, Wheeler was an expert on a number of aspects of archaeology which were really important when you come to look at the civilization of the Indus. The first of these was that he was a master at recording the stratified layers of very complex Roman sites, layers of occupation, palimpsests of occupation and abandonment and building and rebuilding and of burial and storage and so on, which require very precise recording in three dimensions and also intricate photography and drawing. He was also an expert in deciphering complex sites and architecture. And both of these things were really important when he came to India. There are innumerable stories, probably some of them apocryphal, about how Wheeler galvanized the Archaeological Survey of India. In his biography, he wrote how he walked into the office and heard a gentle buzzing noise as armies of clerks dozed their way through the day. He shouted at the top of his voice, and the office was galvanized. Within months, he had started a training school for young Indian students up at the frontier city of Taxila in the northwest, excavated by Marshall. There he inculcated in them, in a generation of students, his disciplined methods for excavating cities and villages. And then in 1945, he turned his attention to Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. And it's safe to say that a great deal of our knowledge of Harappan civilizations results from these extraordinary excavations which he conducted there. Wheeler identified two approaches to excavation, vertical and horizontal. Vertical, you dug down to find the stratified layers of a site, to investigate the history, the architectural history of a citadel, a city wall, or a palace. And then there was horizontal excavation, where you uncovered areas, often using grids of trenches, to establish the layout of towns, the layout of city precincts, of streets, and so on. And he applied both these methods at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. And as a result, he uncovered two remarkably standardized cities, both overlooked by fortified citadels, and both laid out with approximate street grids, the streets and alleyways lined with brick buildings of standardized size and length. This, said Wheeler, was a society of conformists. In his classic account called The Indus Civilization, published in 1953, Mortimer Wheeler stressed this standardization, and he said that the leaders of this state exercised a tight control over their subjects, living apart from them in a town-planned residential quarters up on the citadel, while below them were the teeming streets of the city. He pointed to the seemingly monotonous toolkits of the city, painted pottery that was always depressingly similar, chipped stone and simple metal tools, steatite seals carved with small designs, some of which bore a remarkable resemblance to the Indian god Shiva. Designs and artifacts that varied little from one settlement to another. This was, he said, a civilization based on monotonous, religiously defined principles. It was a theocracy with a religion, he said, that had strong resemblances to much later Hinduism. Like Leonard Woolley, Mortimer Wheeler was a consummate storyteller. His account, for example, of the Roman attack on Maiden Castle in southern England is a classic example of how archaeology can be used to write a very colourful account of an event in the past. The fact that his reconstruction is probably wrong in this particular context is irrelevant. He was a colourful and forceful archaeologist with a fluent pen. His methods are still to this day widely, if not slavishly, used in India and Pakistan. And his view of the Indus civilization as a standardized, very regimented civilization remained unchallenged for a generation, which in science is a long time. And this was partly due to his very strong personality and the very strong hold he had on the minds of his students, who believed, literally, that Wheeler was it. He was archaeology. Today, we're beginning to get a somewhat different perspective on the Harappans. The civilization has been renamed. It's no longer called the Indus civilization. It's called the Harappan civilization. Why? Because it doesn't just encompass the Indus Valley. It uncovers an enormous area of cities and towns, many of them unknown in Wheeler's day. It uncovers the Saraswati Valley, a great river which is now dried up. The influence of the civilization extended over much of Pakistan, from the Himalayan foothills to Bombay in the south. It was centered on the Saraswati as much as it was on the Indus. At the height of its prosperity in the second millennium BC, Harappan civilization covered over 300,000 square miles and was very much more diverse, both culturally and architecturally and socially, than Wheeler would have had one believe on the basis of his excavations, which were relatively limited at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. We also know a great deal more about the trade which the Harappan cities engaged in. We know now, for example, that they traded wool, cloth, leather, cedarwood, and other materials for luxuries like gold, silver, and carnelian from the Persian Gulf and from the Sumerian city-states. During his excavations, Wheeler and his successors have found enormous quantities of imported goods, and it is clear that this city was part, or these cities, were part of a very, very much larger international world where trading connections were maintained for centuries by sea and by land, and that this civilization was of indigenous origin, and these indigenous roots go back to 3000 BC and to the very, very early period of civilization in the eastern Mediterranean. The cities in the Indus were later, but the roots of the civilization lie deep in early agricultural communities and later towns in the Indus region. This was a very diverse, very, very varied and widespread civilization whose influence culturally and economically and religiously was simply enormous. During his excavations, Mortimer Wheeler found skeletons in the uppermost Mohenjo-Daro levels. He was, as I said, a great storyteller. And Wheeler, and I can imagine him saying it because I knew him well, in his English voice would say, "Skeletons? Found in confusion? Ah, yes. These were victims of a flood which destroyed Mohenjo-Daro in about 1700 BC. The way he wrote it, you would think there was an army of skeletons in the upper levels of Mohenjo-Daro. In fact, it was but a handful. And he enlisted the help of a flood expert and others trying to prove that Mohenjo-Daro was destroyed by a flood. In fact, the picture more recent research suggests was very much more complex, as these stories very often are. There were, we suspect, a variety of causes for the demise of Arapan civilization. The first of these was the drying up of the Saraswati River. This may have been the result of earthquake action and possibly drought, or a combination of the two. There were known to be several large, unexcavated cities around the Saraswati River. Remember that we know so little about early civilization in Asia and other parts of the world. There was so much more to do. And if we investigate these cities, we may find that Indus civilization was decimated by the failure of agriculture in this large river valley and by the political and social disruptions which followed. We don't know. Nor do we know why Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro did finally collapse. It is worth mentioning, however, that the Indus Valley is a very dynamic valley. There may have been changes in the river course. There may have been difficulties with flood control. There may have been difficulties with the exhaustion of agricultural soils. The list goes on and on. And probably in this flood-prone, floodplain environment, we really are looking at a situation where the long-term survival of these cities was questionable, and it probably took one or several catastrophic events, including floods, to disrupt the tenure of a civilization which extended its influence over an enormous area of South Asia. And once the cities collapsed, the civilization itself did not disappear. The people, as happened with the Maya of Mesoamerica, dispersed into much smaller communities, and the cultural influence of this civilization and its spiritual influence endured for many centuries, albeit in diluted form, at a time of major political and economic change, which saw the gravity of Indian civilization move from the west in the Indus area to the east, to the Ganges Valley, where many centuries later, the Mauryan civilization came into prominence. The Mauryan civilization excavated by John Marshall. India was lucky in its pioneer archaeologists. Both Marshall and Wheeler were superb masters of their craft for their years, especially Wheeler, and their influence has been enormous. And today, Indian archaeologists carry on their investigations at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro in the tradition of those pioneers. In the next lecture, we're going to take another jump. We're going to go back to Mesoamerica. And I'm going to go off and describe one of the great scientific triumphs, not of the 19th century, but the 20th. That of the decipherment of the intricate and very complicated Maya glyphs, for the Maya script has been deciphered, while that of the Harappans still awaits decipherment. So next time, we will look at writing.